impeccably soporific speech at the GOP convention, and she was even nice to Dr. Phil after he noted crabbily on a promotional spot that first twin Jenna Bush had stuck her tongue out at reporters. Laura seemed to have long forgiven, or was using to ironic effect, her husband's broken promise several decades ago that she would never have to make a political speech. Now she was barnstorming the country on George W. Bush's behalf, speaking her mind, albeit softly, being less than optimistic about the prospects for stem cell research, supporting those smarmy swift boat ads that denigrated John Kerry's military service, and being nasty nice as the first surrogate, calling Rathergate as she saw it. "You know," she said of the 60 Minutes documents that purported to prove her husband was a military slacker, "they probably are altered, and they probably are forgeries, and I think that's terrible, really." Her sable-hued wash-and-go do remained impervious to attacks that others might consider hair-raising. Loyal Democrats have taken to spackling her with the Stepford Wife label. Cultural critic James Wolcott, swept up in an anti-Bush swivet, retracted the nice things he had said about Laura in Vanity Fair and dissed her in his blog as just another warden in a pantsuit and another saccharine phony. Kitty Kelly described her in The Family, the real story of the Bush dynasty, as the Southern Methodist University co-ed who was the go-to girl for dime bags of marijuana. In The Perfect Wife, biographer Anne Gerhart dumped all over her for being a bad mom. "There is plenty that the Bushes don't ask their daughters to do. That much is clear." Austin artists and writers, big fans when Laura was their ardent supporter as Texas First Lady, have raised money to display their unhappiness with the president in full-page newspaper ads in swing states. Prestigious American poets torpedoed a reading she tried to host at the White House. Laura Bush has sailed through all this and more without once asking anyone to shove it. This may be why John Kerry praised her, rather wistfully, I thought, in the first presidential debate as a terrific person and a great first lady. Indeed, Laura has mastered the cleverest first lady's trick of becoming more popular than their more famous spouses. Even better, for herself and her husband, Laura's ascendancy has occurred at a time when the women's vote, lost by Bush-Cheney in 2000, appears to be up for grabs. Noting the First Lady's Xanax-like demeanor and faultless librarian's poise, uber-feminist and Gore 2000 advisor Naomi Wolf conceded that the Bush team has brilliantly closed the gender gap by putting Laura, Condoleezza Rice, Lynn Cheney, and other goody-goody GOP goddesses out front, in stark contrast to Teresa Hines Carey, whom Republicans like to portray as Ms. Tabasco and Onions, even though Mrs. Cheney could easily compete for the title. Laura's fans and critics alike tend to see her enormous popularity as either a reaction to her pushy predecessor or to her own husband, who can inspire paranoid psychosis in his detractors with just one well-timed smirk. Or they credit Laura's success, she couldn't possibly do it alone, to the stark, deadly efficiency of Team Bush, particularly the recently returned Iron Maiden Karen Hughes. All of these political assists may indeed have helped the First Lady become nearly as popular as her stiletto-shrewd mother-in-law. But it is time to give credit where credit is due. Laura Bush is probably our most brilliant First Lady to date because she understands the kind of woman the American public really wants as its representative and role model, a complete and total cipher. She has intentionally made herself into a blank screen upon which they can project their own ideas about womanhood. Consider the evidence. Unlike a great many political wives, Nancy Reagan, Rosalind Carter, and Hillary Clinton come to mind, Laura Bush knew what the job entailed and early on declared her indifference. Friends Jan and Joe O'Neill had to campaign for 2 years before she would agree to meet George W. Bush, and even then, the man Laura eventually married wasn't exactly wearing a sandwich board that said, "Future President of the USA," or even "Future City Councilman." Bush then was just a good-time Midland oil man, something of a galoot. Note to Freudians, Laura's father was known for his exuberance. He was the kind of guy who broke into "Hello, Dolly" when Laura's blonde friends walked in the door. Assuming George's Wells would have eventually come in, and given his history, that's a big assumption, but something else might have come along, Laura probably envisioned a future as a Midland society matron, not a role to which all ambitious career women aspire, but a cushy, cozy life nevertheless. Biographers tend to focus on the hot, dry, dusty landscape of Midland, an innocent life of burgers at Agnes Drive-In and of cruising the flat, windswept streets of West Texas, said the Washington Post, overlooking that many of the city's community leaders were wealthy Eastern transplants, like her suitor's parents, who brought the manners and mores of the American aristocracy with them. It was, and is, on the surface at least, an urban oasis of book clubs, garden clubs, country clubs, and the kind of strange rites that spring up in isolated, wealthy communities. In other words, Laura wasn't the kind of wife who staked her well-being on her husband's success in the world. If George could have made himself into an even semi-successful citizen of Midland, she probably would have been content to raise her children in her hometown, reading, carpooling, visiting with her parents, and taking the occasional trip on somebody's private jet. Not that Midland was dull. "In Midland, you have to make your own fun," a former resident explained to me. The newlyweds, for instance, attended a party in which smashing Waterford crystal goblets on the edge of a swimming pool passed for entertainment, as did a dirty T-shirt contest for which the Bushes arrived wearing complimentary ensembles that read, "I love Bush's thingy and I love Bushy things." Once the couple moved to Dallas, where in 1987 Bush found gainful employment as the managing general partner of the Texas Rangers, George and Laura's lives were somewhat more refined, but no less comfortable. They nestled into prosperous, leafy Preston Hollow, stayed focused on their much-wanted twins, and showed up at the baseball stadium whenever time permitted, which was often. He liked to autograph baseballs for visitors between innings, a sign perhaps that he had his eye on bigger things. Laura lived as she always had, surrounded by close friends and raising the girls. So when her husband voiced his ambitions to run for governor in the early 90s, it made perfect sense that Laura would be reluctant to go along. She had loved campaigning with him when he ran unsuccessfully for Congress in 1978. She had him all to herself, but the comforts of North Dallas life and the demands of motherhood and, most likely, a few more years as part of the extended Bush clan had made her averse to the role of political wife. In exchange for her blessing, George promised that he would never make her do anything in support of his political career, unless, of course, she wanted to. This was the same deal, by the way, that backfired on Howard Dean and his wife Judith Steinberg. The public was more comfortable with Laura's preference to stay home with her girls than Judith's desire to keep up with her internal medicine practice. If she was ambivalent about becoming a public figure following her husband's 1994 gubernatorial victory against Ann Richards, maybe, like a lot of people, Laura didn't believe it would happen. She adapted, in her own way, to life in the Capitol. The cadre of studiously underdressed Austin Democratic women who worried that she would impose Escada suits and flashy Dallas jewelry on the populace was immensely relieved when she showed a preference for slacks, rubber-soled shoes, and liberals. Many of Laura's oldest friends were progressive Austin Dems, wealthy progressives, but progressives nevertheless. If you were to characterize them, clarified one Austin social observer, you'd think not Republican. She haunted local antiques shops, tweaked the governor's mansion, put the girls in public school, stayed late at parties long after her teetotaling husband left for bed, and started a statewide book festival with her seriously Democratic friend Mary Margaret Farabee. "Well, if I'm going to be a public figure, I might as well do what I've always liked doing," Laura told a reporter at the time, "which means acting like a librarian and getting people interested in reading." In this way, the First Lady of Texas became an enormous asset to the image of intellectual sophistication Texas was trying to present to the world and the era of good feeling that prevailed in the capital. Bob Bullock was George W. Bush's mentor then, and Karl Rove was just a political consultant. While the Republican governor was stressing bipartisanship, it didn't hurt that his wife seemed to be a closet lefty. Laura rarely said what she believed in public, but her comfortable, contained silence left people with the impression that she agreed with just about everyone. "He couldn't be all bad if she married him," went the thinking among those who'd sworn they'd never forgive George for defeating their beloved Anne. Some things changed for Laura when her husband went public with his presidential ambitions. Again, she was a reluctant campaigner, and again, we have to assume that some version of the Treaty of North Dallas remained in place, but not everything could stay the same. I interviewed Laura in 1998 for a national magazine, hoping she might help me explain Bush to the rest of the country, who thought of him only as George Jr. There was construction around the front of the governor's mansion that sunny winter morning, so Laura greeted me warmly at a back door, as if I were a new neighbor she'd heard nice things about. But the slacks and rubber-soled shoes had already been replaced by sensible pumps and a nice Republican suit, the jewel tone of choice being purple, I recall. Her gaze from those preternaturally turquoise eyes was friendly but assessing. We warmed up with small talk about the mansion's fabrics and furniture. Her voice remained soft and animated when she complimented me on a story I'd written, notable then and in retrospect because it was about a gay marriage. Good politics, I thought at the time. But when we settled in for the interview, Laura sat ramrod straight, sometimes folding her hands neatly in her lap, sometimes folding her arms across her chest in classic "you are the enemy now" posture. She reminded me a little of Ann Richards then, never a fan of the press. The casual woman who liked to steal out of the mansion for long walks and cheer her daughter's friends at high school baseball games had already been packed up for storage. On the topic of George W. Bush, her involvement with his retreat from alcohol in 1986, her desire to help him be a uniter, not a divider, she was careful and controlled, her efficient smile slipping every once in a while into a small grimace. That was all I was going to get. A few well-chosen, non-revealing statements. The Buddhists warned that unhappiness can come from attachments, and Laura wasn't holding fast to her happy life as the governor's wife. She was moving on. I was the one stuck in the past, expecting the person she'd been. It was this ability to move forward with the steady, steely assurance of a Coast Guard cutter that seems to have confounded the national press when she arrived in Washington. They wanted to know her. She didn't want them to. She was perfectly happy to let them think she was bland or dull. She wasn't going to expend her energy changing their minds. At one point, slightly annoyed by her press, she told a reporter that she wasn't shy, she was introverted, a sorority girl's delicate way of saying she'd rather be alone than with members of the media. The press tried to retaliate. Laura's varied life as an academic, the master's in library science, a teacher of poor kids for nearly a decade, a stay-at-home mom, and a devoted wife, was portrayed not as a paradigm of feminist flexibility, but as an example of a woman whose myriad choices ultimately meant nothing, except that every choice she had made could be used to advance her husband's career. "She is the Play-Doh First Lady," wrote the New Republic in August 2001. "Mold her into whatever shape you want, then stamp her back down into a pile of putty for her next audience." The author added that when Laura lunched with Hillary Clinton as the latter was leaving the White House, the new First Lady wore a terrible purple plaid number, looking like nothing so much as a country mouse. She could not possibly be smart. That she was an insatiable reader was met with incredulity, particularly when she cited an imposing chapter in The Brothers Karamazov as her favorite part of her favorite novel. Wrote the author, asked about this ambiguous and unsettling passage in which Christ returns to earth only to be arrested as a heretic and threatened with burning at the stake, Laura replied bafflingly, "It's about life, and it's about death, and it's about Christ. I find it really reassuring." It's only baffling, of course, if you refuse to take Laura at her word, but the First Lady plainly didn't care what the journalist thought. She later joked about donating her plaid suit to a historical clothing collection, and to this day keeps the Brothers Karamazov on her White House website reading list. "If I differ with my husband, I'm not going to tell you about it," Laura told a reporter in 2000, which, as it turns out, was the last word on her intention to maintain a zone of privacy around her feelings and opinions. It was the Austin technique, writ large. The less she said, the more the public seemed to project its own feelings onto her. And most of those feelings were helped along by the kind of harmless and heartwarming appearances no one could carp about. Laura was in favor of reading, good. She was against heart disease in women, great. And she never changed her hairstyle, a relief. And she had absolutely no intention of participating in a co-presidency, ditto. The idea of using the First Lady's job as a bully pulpit didn't suit her solitary, self-effacing temperament. And it didn't suit the times, which even before September 11th were rancorous enough without throwing a Hillary type into the mix. Instead, Laura told reporters that Lady Bird Johnson was her White House model, which satisfied just about everyone. Both women were gracious. Both women showed a knack for handling cantankerous men. Both women knew how to keep out of trouble. But Laura also had a pinch of Jackie in her sly wit and passion for the arts. Soon enough, no one could mistake her for a cowgirl. She also had more than a little in common with Bess Truman, who retreated to Independence, Missouri for months at a time because she hated the rigmarole of Washington. Austinites got used to seeing the First Lady sipping margaritas with friends at Manuel's while her husband flew solo in Washington. People in Midland got a charge out of seeing an official government plane on the airport tarmac when Laura got a hankering to visit her mom. George opted for the White House. Laura opted to redo the house in Crawford. Her biographers struggled mightily to add drama and pathos to a life that was, with a few exceptions, supremely happy and serenely uneventful. Reading these accounts, you cannot help longing for a chronicler like Virginia Woolf, who knew how to endow seemingly ordinary people with rich internal lives, or Larry McMurtry, who understands the unshakable reserve of West Texas women. At least three biographies have been written about Laura, three and a half if you count her share of George and Laura by Christopher Anderson. And in all, the reader comes out knowing almost less about her at the end than at the beginning. The same stories are recycled endlessly with little to no elaboration from her. Hence, the repercussions of a horrible automobile accident in which she ran a stop sign and killed a close high school friend are used to explain variously her passion for order, the arranging of her bookcases according to the Dewey Decimal System, and the sponging down of homes with Clorox. The climactic moment in which she persuaded her husband to stop drinking is used to show her inner fortitude and profound influence, even though she's denied that she ever spoke up in such a manner. Laura went from being the cowed librarian to her hot-tempered husband's personal Prozac. She alone could control him with words like, "Rein it in, Bubba," according to the New York Times. Then came September 11th. Just as the events following that awful day proved to be her husband's finest hours, they were Laura's too, providing the perfect intersection of her personality and the nation's needs. As biographer Gerhardt put it, the woman who had the capacity to lie for hours on a sofa, reading, was suddenly logging 16-hour days, and in full public view, perfectly groomed, suit pressed, hair in place, and always waterproof mascara. The same emotional clarity that had guided her in composing her life now informed a new mission. She calmed, she comforted, she selected just the right hymns for the National Cathedral service, and she visited the site of the crash of Flight 93 in a lonely, muddy field in Pennsylvania. Just before George W. Bush's 2002 State of the Union address, a USA Today CNN Gallup poll reported that Laura was the most admired woman in America. "I actually think that the American people think that the First Lady ought to do whatever she wants to do," she said. It seems to have worked for her. Many critics of the Bush family want to believe that the current, more partisan incarnation of the First Lady displays her obeisance to the family machine. "She might as well be wrapped in veils," one Democratic friend groused to me. "She took up for the entire clan when she bashed," in a nice way, of course, "the Bush snubbing Nancy Reagan over stem cell research. But Laura possessed many Bush-like tendencies before she ever became one. She blended so effortlessly into the family that her more progressive friends just failed to notice. She's always been better at being a Bush, the idealized, admirable, loving family George H.W. Bush and his wife Barbara concocted, than the Bushes themselves. Before she married, Laura devoted a decade or so to helping the kind of people her husband never showed much interest in until he decided to run for office. She taught school in poor communities, and though her husband performed brief volunteer work with underprivileged kids for a Houston organization called PULL in the early 70s, reporters have long wondered whether this was some form of mandated community service for goodness knows what. Laura's reticence might be attributed to the fabled silences of West Texans, but it could easily pass for that of a musty but well-bred East Coast aristocrat, like the Connecticut Bushes. The pull of the past must have felt like an undertow to George when he met Laura. It's no wonder the two married expeditiously after a three-month courtship. Barbara Bush early on singled Laura out from among her daughters-in-law as the only one who was First Lady material. She was, by nature and preference, intent on staying out of the way. "I have the best wife for the line of work that I'm in," the president once told a reporter. "She doesn't try to steal the limelight." Or, as a mutual friend put it, "Bush didn't have to marry his mother because he is his mother." Laura didn't crave attention like her ambitious in-laws, but that doesn't mean she was a pushover. It was inconceivable that she would ever embarrass the family as Jeb's wife, Columba, did when she was fined for failing to declare jewelry and clothes she brought back into the U.S. several years ago, or try to outshine Barbara as Neil's wife, Sharon, did in the pre-Silverado scandal days in Denver and in her pre-divorce Houston society era. Still, Laura neatly deflected comparisons between herself and her mother-in-law. "Lady Bird is my role model, just by being herself. She was this way from the beginning." At the family compound in May, she avoided the Olympic trials that passed for family sporting events, staking out instead a spot on the front porch with her books and cigarettes. "What do you do?" George H.W. Bush's famously competitive mother, Dorothy, asked Laura when she was newly wed in 1977. "I read and I smoke," Laura replied. Midlandese for "shove it." The ever-watchful Barbara would later tidy up her daughter-in-law's line in her 1994 memoir, claiming that Laura had actually said, "I read, I smoke, and I admire," possibly grafting a few words from her own note to a Smith College alumni magazine. "I play tennis, do volunteer work, and admire George Bush." By keeping the family at some distance and childhood friends close, Laura probably saved herself from the depressions suffered by political wives in general, and Bush women in particular. Life in China was tough on Barbara Bush, by her own admission, as were the many times her husband left her alone to raise their ever-expanding brood. Laura, faced with a husband who wouldn't own up to his drinking problem, threatened to walk when the situation became intolerable. It isn't just Kitty Kelly who suggested that Bush treated his wife like a doormat, or worse, when he was in his cups. People in Midland and in Washington, where George went to help his father on his 1988 campaign, saw the same short-tempered, dismissive oaf at social events. Whether Laura was the person who directly intervened to get her husband to stop drinking, or simply one of many who attempted to get Bush sober, she was soon characterized by Bush himself as the person who had saved him. She demurely denied doing any such thing, but the mythology grew when George faltered on the campaign trail during the 2000 race, and Laura was supposedly the only person who could quiet him down. "She brought calm and serenity to his bearing," Spinmeister Mark McKinnon told This Magazine in April 2001. "He was happier, more at ease, less distracted. Even on the airplane, he was more likely to relax. If she wasn't there, he'd bounce around the plane." Laura looked like a cavalry of one each time she made those sojourns to the front, and it never really occurred to anyone to ask why she hadn't been there all along. Riding to the rescue boosted Laura's popularity, while it humanized her husband, a neat trick originally perfected by Lady Bird Johnson. In the passive-aggressive playbook, less is always more. The twins act out in public, and Laura explains that she never wanted them to feel oppressed by family pressures. Meanwhile, she lets them get back at their dad for his absences in much the same way he exacted revenge on his own father. Laura's distaste for public life jibes perfectly with her husband's propensity for privacy, though she wants to be alone because she likes being alone, and he likes being alone because he doesn't like pesky, prying reporters. Either way, the result is the same. Laura has learned how to use the Bush machine to get what she needs. When Gerhardt, who covered the First Lady for the Washington Post, sent her a letter asking for her cooperation with a biography, Laura never responded. Word came from Karen Hughes, then a special advisor to George Bush, that it was too soon for such a book. Was it the cautious White House or the cautious First Lady or both who had turned her down? Gerhardt never knew. Since publication of that book, the vow of silence has extended even further from Laura's center of gravity. After Gerhardt criticized the behavior of the twins in The Perfect Wife, members of Laura's Austin Book Club, who had been content to recycle the same pabulum on her behalf for years, decided to stay mum about their most famous participant. Occasionally, these loyalists can go too far in their self-imposed protectiveness, as when a group of Laura's friends took over the Texas Book Festival, of which this magazine is a sponsor, this year, and tried to institute a plan to ban political books, this being an election year, and many of the books being less than complimentary about her husband. Thankfully, they reconsidered, but almost simultaneously, a rumor swept through Austin that Texas writers and artists who had signed a petition against the war, a petition that was to run as an ad in the New York Times if enough money was raised, would be banned from the book festival. This report also turned out to be false, but Laura's friends weren't shy about leaning on book festival participants who made their anti-war opinions public. If I'd known my chicken dinner came with an oath of loyalty, I wouldn't have eaten it, said one of the petition signers. But of course, it did. From her earliest days as a political wife, Laura has said that her first loyalty is to her husband, and nothing in her character has ever suggested that she would stray from that promise, despite separate vacations in Crawford. The pillow talk wished for by her Austin friends is a thing of the past, if it ever existed. When the First Lady's celebration of poetry threatened to collapse in a firestone of rancor over the 2003 invasion of Iraq, she chose to have the event postponed indefinitely rather than embarrass the president. It's a shame Laura didn't believe or wasn't allowed to show that she possessed the fortitude of Lady Bird, who famously and politely stood her ground when Eartha Kitt blamed her for her husband's war at a White House women's luncheon in 1967. Lady Bird listened while the singer harangued her. "I know the feeling of having a baby come out of my guts. I have a baby, and then you send him off to war." Then gathered herself and replied, "Because there is a war on, that doesn't give us a free ticket not to try to work for better things, against crime in the streets, and for better education and better health for our people." Today, protesters are shouted down during the First Lady's speeches, or, in the case of a New Jersey woman whose son was killed in Iraq, handcuffed and charged with trespassing. Because of her reticence, Laura will probably never enjoy the same legacy as her mother-in-law or Lady Bird, both of whom found causes and pushed them with a passion that assured some sort of historical niche for themselves. But it's likely that Laura Bush, who never aspired to the job in the first place, isn't interested in any return other than a return to normalcy. The country is crazy, and she's standing still, waiting for the days when her life will again be occupied solely with friends and family. Maybe in these times, that's just what the country needs. West Toward Home. For 14 years, Laura Bush lived in two of the grandest homes imaginable, the Governor's Mansion and the White House. But it was the time she spent in a series of modest dwellings in Midland, a place of lonesome highways and stinging sandstorms, that made her who she is today. By Brian D. Sweeney. From the June 2010 issue of Texas Monthly. Long before Laura Welch met an aspiring politician named George W. Bush, she defined herself by the city where she had been born and raised, Midland. Though she lived all across the state as a young woman, she earned a bachelor's degree in Dallas, she taught elementary school in Houston, and she worked as a librarian in Austin. She was a pure product of West Texas. Her mother came from El Paso, her father from Lubbock. She had deep roots across the region, and as a little girl, she spent hours in the car traveling between cities with her parents. In Midland, isolated in that vast expanse of desert and sky, she learned to be independent, to work hard, and to accept the fact that people didn't talk much about their problems. She took those values with her, all the way to the governor's mansion and, ultimately, the White House. However, as she writes in her new memoir, Spoken from the Heart, she never had such lofty aspirations. The daughter of a hard-working home builder who enjoyed playing gin rummy and betting on football games, and a stay-at-home mom who loved birding and reading, she was a model student who had a nearly idyllic childhood of sleepovers, swimming parties, and nights at the drive-in, until 2 days after her 17th birthday, when a tragic accident changed her life forever. Now, 63, she has returned to Dallas with President Bush to a spacious ranch-style home on Daria Place in Preston Hollow, about 6 hours away from the house she lived in on the corner of Estes and Big Spring when she was 8. The Bushes have begun work on what she describes as the most important project left in their lives, the George W. Bush Presidential Center on the campus of Southern Methodist University, where she first struck out on her own 46 years ago. Yet she remains an unlikely international figure who never forgot her roots. A former librarian who once read Russian novels by the pool before she became a key witness to some of the most critical events of the early 21st century. Brian D. Sweeney, you and President Bush have been back in Texas for more than a year now. How have you adjusted to private life? Laura Bush, we feel great. George and I are very happy to be back home in Texas, the promised land, as he calls it. We are unbelievably grateful to have had the opportunity to live in Washington in our magnificent White House. And now we are happy to be home and lead a normal life. I didn't really know I was stressed when I lived there until after we had left. I write this in the book, but all of a sudden, there was buoyancy to my life that I had forgotten I had ever had. The memoir ended up being psychologically cathartic. BDS, what was the significance of making Midland your first stop on your way home from Washington? LB, there was a great sense of security in touching down in Midland after leaving Washington and going to the center of town to meet the thousands of people who were welcoming us home. These are people we had known all of our lives. They were our neighbors or the parents of our friends or people we knew growing up. It was a wonderful feeling of security and, frankly, love. We know those people love us and we love them. BDS, you write in Spoken from the Heart, it helped to be fearless if you lived in Midland. What did you mean by that? LB, when we were kids, we did whatever we wanted to do in Midland. We rode our bikes everywhere, we went everywhere, and in many ways we were oblivious to adults. I think that growing up in places like Tyler or Beaumont or other oil towns might have been similar to growing up in Midland. The difference, of course, is that Midland is in West Texas, where we didn't have trees, but we did have sandstorms. My friends and I developed a strong sense of friendship just from being in the same boat, in the sense that Midland was so remote, sitting out there in the desert, and all we knew was living in that space. You remember that beautiful, huge sky, and you remember the sound of the cicadas and the feeling of that dry, late afternoon heat. BDS. Certainly one of the things that you are known for is the creation of the Texas Book Festival, and your mother is the one who first inspired your love of reading when you were young. LB. She was a great reader, and she even took an extension class on children's literature in case she wanted to get a teaching certificate. She would discuss all of those great books with me, and we would read them together. BDS. But not all of the books you read growing up were so tame, right? LB. Someone started passing around a paperback copy of Lady Chatterley's Lover in high school, and they had put the cover of another book on it, as if that was the most risque thing to read. I read it in a math or science class with my textbook propped up in front of it. I did that a lot, in fact. I'd find myself in the middle of a book that I didn't want to put down, so I'd read it in class when I wasn't paying that much attention to that particular subject. BDS. How did you and your friends spend time outside class? LB. What we did a lot was drive around, of course. All of us did. We drove around with our boyfriends, with groups of girls, going from Agnes Drive-In for a Coke to the drive-in theaters that ringed Midland to watch a movie. My friend Reagan Gammon, a founder and a member of the executive board of the Texas Book Festival, and I would drive out to Mr. X's, a spot on the south side of town known for its taquitos and fried chicken livers, where we could smoke and no one could see us. BDS. There are a lot of references to smoking in the book, kids and parents and smoking at one another's houses. Did you have a hard time quitting? LB. Yeah, sure. Years later, I read every book in a public library in Cashmere Gardens in Houston about trying to quit. My daddy was able to quit only after he had part of his lung removed. That was really part of Texas life in the 40s and 50s. All the adults that we knew smoked. BDS. In many ways, you had a perfect childhood in Midland, but all of that changed 2 days after your 17th birthday, on November 6th, 1964. You were driving with your friend Judy Dykes, and you were on your way to see a movie. You ran a stop sign at the intersection of Big Spring and the Loop on the north side of town, and you hit a car driven by your friend and classmate Mike Douglas, killing him. You write, "In the aftermath, all I felt was guilty. Very guilty. In fact, I still do. It is a guilt I will carry for the rest of my life, far more visible to me than the scar etched in the bump on my knee." LB. I tried to write about it in a way that was very candid. It was a terrible, terrible life experience. Any accident that would have been bad, but an accident that caused a death, and beyond that, the death of my really close friend, made it even more tragic and horrible. Everyone knew and loved Mike. He and Reagan had even dated. We had been friends for years. George and I hosted a reunion at the White House for the class of 1964, and many of those people had been close friends of Mike's. BDS. Afterward, you say that friends and family came over to talk to your parents, but no one ever really talked about it with you, not even your mom and dad. LB. I think that was the way that people lived back then, especially in West Texas. You didn't talk about things that bothered you, and that's probably the signal that I gave to them. Certainly Reagan and I have talked about it over the years. The only comfort I've found is that time does pass, but the lesson is also that there isn't anything you can do about some things. As much as you wish that weren't the case, you just deal with it. So I dealt with it by not talking about it. BDS. You also didn't attend the funeral, and you say that you still regret that you never reached out to the Douglases because you assumed that they wouldn't want to hear from you. LB, if I had had any more maturity, I probably would have realized that wasn't the case, but I didn't. And there were certain things related to the accident that I didn't realize until later in life, when I had Barbara and Jenna, and I was a mother. And I didn't understand until I was writing the book how it looked through mother's and daddy's eyes. I never thought of what they thought or how sick they must have been with worry or grief. I always thought of it only from my viewpoint. It wasn't until I was a 60-year-old woman writing the book that I thought about it from someone else's perspective. BDS, you must have worried every time Barbara and Jenna left with their friends in high school. LB, exactly. I always worried about what could happen to them and what did happen to some of their friends. They didn't know about the accident until a DPS agent told them when George was governor and we were living in Austin. I'm sure the officer who told them assumed they did know and that it was just part of a conversation. We had never told them. BDS. Just a few months after the accident, you were headed to Dallas as an undergraduate at Southern Methodist University. Was that a difficult transition? LB. It wasn't so much a transition from Midland to the big city as it was a transition to college life and living with other people. After all those years of being an only child, I went off to SMU with a close group of friends, girls I had known my whole life. One of those friends had read a biography of Doak Walker in the 7th grade and gave it to me to read. Her parents had gone to SMU, and she always knew that's where she was going to go. But that was long before I had any idea where I was going. I was young, still 17 and immature, and I think I would have been a better student had I been older. I didn't have a car when I came to Dallas, and my friends really didn't either, so we were fairly isolated on campus, though we did go to places like El Toro Room over on Greenville Avenue. BDS. On campus, you met another woman who would become important in your life, Professor Harriet Earhart, who inspired you to become a librarian. LB. She was a magnificent teacher. She was a wonderful storyteller, and she knew children's literature very well. She talked about these books in class in a way that made them even better. She enhanced them. She had such an impact on me, but I didn't see her again until George was elected governor and she was serving in the State House of Representatives. BDS. As a Democrat, correct? LB. Yes, as a Democrat. A liberal Democrat, I might add. BDS. You would go on to live and work in Houston and Austin, but it would still be several years before you would meet George back in Midland. LB. Midland is what he remembers as his childhood, and we both went to San Jacinto Junior High together, but we didn't know each other then. We just passed in the halls. His family then moved to Houston when he was in the 8th grade. Years later, when he came back to fly for the Texas Air National Guard in Houston, we both lived at the Chateau Dijon, but our apartments were on opposite sides, and we never met, which was great, because it probably would not have been the right time for us. Then, when I went back home one summer to see my parents, when I was a librarian at Molly Dawson Elementary in Austin, our friends Joey O'Neill and his wife Jan invited us to dinner. BDS. In fact, you two hit it off and went on a date the very next day at what you call the most beautiful place in Midland, the miniature golf course. LB. If you can imagine, it's because of those beautiful old trees. There are no native trees in Midland. The miniature golf course had these amazing elms. BDS. Would it have been possible for you to imagine on that night that your relationship would eventually lead you to the White House? LB. No, not at all. His dad was the candidate. When I lived in Houston, he had run for the U.S. Senate, and some of my friends worked as volunteers on that campaign. So I was aware of that. And then when I met George, I knew he was interested in running for Congressman George Mahon's seat. It sounded like a great adventure, and it was. We were in his Cutlass together all day, driving from town to town, going to Hereford or wherever, just talking. It was a great way to start a marriage. BDS. Speaking of Congressman Mahon, you write that in 1969 you went to Washington and applied for a job in his office, but you didn't get it because you didn't know how to type. LB. Those seemingly coincidental moments are so interesting. To think that if my life had turned off in any of those directions, for instance, if I had stayed in Washington and worked for Congressman Mahon, I would have lived a very different life. And meeting George the way I did, I think that's just how life is in Texas for people who have grown up here and lived in a lot of different towns. You meet new people because of the people you already know. You have a large network of friends. BDS, you said that you were able to have a fairly normal life in Austin, but that obviously changed when you moved to Washington. How did being the First Lady of Texas prepare you for life in the White House? LB, it was very helpful to have been the First Lady of Texas, just for the easiest, the most mundane things, how to do the Christmas card or how to entertain. I already had a lot of ideas about that. When we moved to Washington, it wasn't something I had to worry about. Of course, I had watched Barbara Bush as the First Lady of the United States. When we moved to Austin, we never dreamed we would move to Washington. So having had the Bushes as my parents was very beneficial in helping me to learn to be both First Lady of Texas and of the United States. And I carried a lot of the same issues with me: early childhood cognitive development and the Texas Book Festival. It made sense to try to develop a national book festival. Every part of that experience really helped me. BDS, you have also mentioned Lady Bird Johnson as one of your role models, and she once dictated into her diary about the stress of living in the White House. Shortly after LBJ became president, she noted that some tension had developed between them, saying, "If there was anything of a gulf between me and him, there never was anything of a gulf between Linda Bird and him, so I wanted her to be there." Did being in the White House ever cause friction between you and President Bush? LB, no, it really didn't. There's something about being there together and being in this situation together that brought us even closer. We have a very close relationship, and we always have. I think that just being in the same room together is comforting for us. I always thought that we had each other's back in a way that I think is really necessary. George has said, living in the White House is a little like living in a museum. And if you don't live there with love, it can be a really cold place. BDS, certainly the nation went through a number of traumatic events during your husband's administration. Were there things, however, that you thought the national media never understood about his presidency? LB, oh yeah, of course, lots of things. Laughs. I'm being facetious. What I think happens is that we're in this 24-hour news cycle, and there's no time for reflection. One of the things I've tried to do is to remind people what it was like on September 11th, how we were all unified and vulnerable and grieving. I've tried to remind people of the anxiety that everyone had. We had that anxiety every single day while living in the White House. That's what I guess is called the burden, if there is such a thing, of the office. Even in the best of times, you worry. Every day something new comes across the desk of the president, so it's hard even for the president to find time to reflect. You're too much in the moment of what's happening right then. George believes that it is the responsibility of the president to try to look ahead and to think, what's going to happen in 5 years? That's something we've enjoyed as we've been writing our books. President Bush's memoir, Decision Points, is scheduled to be released on November 9th. He's found it very interesting to have the chance to reflect on his time in office. Looking back now, are there issues or initiatives that you feel were left unfinished? Do you have any regrets from your time in Washington? LB, the specific thing that I think about is the construction of the hospital in Basra that we worked on for so long, and today I don't even know what the status of it is. But I don't have regrets. I did the very best I could, and I think I did a lot. Of course, many of the issues you work on will never be finished. When it comes to early childhood education, for example, there will always be a new first grade class. There will always be a new crop of teachers. BDS. Last September, I attended a luncheon in which you were honored by Marian Anderson as a living legend. The talk of the day was about the controversy surrounding President Barack Obama's decision to address the nation's school children. Someone asked you about that and you replied, "I'm out of that business." But can a member of the Bush family really ever be out of politics? LB, I think what I meant was I wasn't interested in making political commentary. We are still in the policy business, and that's what we want to do with the Bush Institute at SMU. But George has also chosen not to get involved in any political commentary. He thinks he owes it to the office of the president not to second-guess the current president. BDS. Clearly, there are members of the family who continue to have an interest in politics. Is that something you see as a future path for either Barbara or Jenna? LB. You know, I think the Bushes were gratified that both George and Jeb were interested in politics, because you don't know if running for office is going to be too difficult on your children. So I think they were pleased, because that meant they didn't ruin their lives after all. As for Barbara or Jenna, I doubt that they will ever run, but you can never say never.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9. Now playing on the Noon Book Hour, we continue our selections from the Christmas shelf with Skipping Christmas by John Grisham. Luther and Nora Crank are fed up with the chaos of Christmas, the endless shopping lists, the hassle of decorating the tree. Where has all the joy gone? This year, celebrating seems like too much effort, and with their only child off in Peru, they decide that just this once, they'll skip the holidays. They spend their Christmas budget on a Caribbean cruise and happily settle in for a restful holiday season, free of rooftop snowmen and festive parties. But the Cranks soon learn that their vacation from Christmas isn't much of a vacation at all, and that skipping the holidays has consequences they didn't bargain for. A modern Christmas classic, this is a charming and hilarious look at the mayhem and madness that have become ingrained in our holiday tradition. Skipping Christmas by John Grisham, airing weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 68 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, a few showers with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Your dial is set for fun. Just close your eyes and be solitude. Your favorite bands are on the stands, and Mr. Miller puts you in the mood. It's make-believe ballroom time, the hour of sweet romance. Here's your make-believe ballroom. Come on, children, let's dance, let's dance.
Hi folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S. as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world and welcome to the ballroom, and thanks for joining me this hour as I share some wonderful swing, jazz, and big band music, and many of the stories behind the records I am going to play for you this hour. Hope you're all doing well. You know, for many years, I broadcast stock car racing, and I was doing a cable series in the Northeast on Verizon's Fios One, and one of the guys on the production crew was actually named Chris Columbus. Yes, Christopher Columbus, although his first name was spelt with a K. A few days ago, I got an email from an auto racing broadcasting newsletter I belonged to for many, many years, and it acknowledged Chris Columbus's birthday. So in honor of you, my friend, Chris Columbus with a K, to get things started today, I offer you the Fletcher Henderson version of Christopher Columbus with a C, composed by Chu Berry. Thank you. Fletcher Henderson's Christopher Columbus. Now let's move from the happiness of a birthday to some true heartache. The song Heartaches was, and it does remain, a popular song with music by Al Hoffman and lyrics by John Klenner. Heartaches was originally published in 1931, and it was placed on all the record labels of the time, Victor, Columbia, Brunswick, and the many dime store labels, but it was not a particularly big hit at the time. It never really received any stupendous success. The most popular recorded version of the song was by the Ted Weems Orchestra, with Elmo Tanner whistling on the record. The recording was made in 1933 on Bluebird, and it was basically a novelty fast rumba tempo, but it just didn't sell very well. Let's listen to the Ted Weems Orchestra version of Heartaches. After the record, I'm going to tell you an incredible story of how this mildly popular song became a big hit. Ted Weems dissolved his band in early 1942 after leaving to fight in World War II. Now the incredible story behind the song. In early 1947, Kurt Webster, who was a disc jockey on WBT in Charlotte, North Carolina, that was a 50,000-watt station, and at that time, 50,000 watts reached pretty much across the East Coast. Well, he decided to play Weems' version of Heartaches. Webster enjoyed the tune, and it entered his regular rotation. That led to listeners frequently requesting it, and Heartaches, the once little paid attention to song, gained national attention, and the original Weems version sold like hotcakes. Weems ended up playing on this success, actually reviving his band briefly to capitalize on the record's huge sales. So, as Weems must have thought, 14 years later, if at first you don't succeed, try again.